tough for the sake of being tough by itself doesn't work. And the reason I think people remember is because what we are all doing in some way is trying to relate to them what the real world is. I used to tell my students, look, we're in the college community right now. You're getting prepared for the rest of your life. If you're a business student, you got your general education subjects, which are going to help you live your life. And then you got your business subjects. Well, your business subjects are meant to prepare you for the real world. And like it or not, that real world will not conform to you. And I really believe that even today with the young people who, like you say, don't like authority and all of that. Business does not conform to them a whole lot. It will a little bit to recruit them and get them in. But if they don't follow the rules and don't do what they're supposed to do, they get in trouble and they don't make it. So I think it's because what we do is prepare them for reality.
The bison, 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 the bison.
Hello, bison. Today's Nichols College Alumni Experience podcast features Professor Larry Downs, who taught in the marketing program at Nichols from 1979 until his retirement in 2012, having served as marketing chair for over 15 years. He started his career at Post Cereals, introducing Honeycomb Cereal to the market. He rebranded Post Raisin Bran cereal and went on to work for Pfizer, repositioning the Bengay ointment brand and introducing Visine eye drops to the market with the slogan, Visine gets the red out. Today, Larry and I will talk about his time in corporate America, the show Mad Men, some of his favorite teaching moments at Nichols College, and explain the origin of some of the famous Downsisms. Welcome to the Nichols College Alumni Experience Podcast, Larry.
Well, good. It's nice to talk with you, Brent. How are things up there in Dudley?
We're doing the best we can, and the students seem to really like in-person classes over online classes, but we want to make sure that we're doing everything to keep them and the faculty and the staff safe.
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad to hear that they're starting up.
I have to admit, it's pretty good to hear your voice. It's been a while. It brings back a lot of memories. I was working at the in the admissions office, and at the time you were the marketing chair, and you did a lot for the open houses. You used to run an open house called the Young Business Professionals Roundtable, which was always, I think, the highest yielding open house that Nichols did.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, too.
Now, I've told a lot of alumni that I'll be interviewing you today. A lot of them told me about their memories of you. I mentioned some of the companies you've worked for in the introduction, but can we go a little bit more into detail about how you got your start in the marketing world?
You know, I joined the Marine Corps right out of high school. And after the Marine Corps, was 3.5 years active. I worked for a year in a factory at Eastman Kodak, and then I went to college at RIT, which is co-op work school. And at the end of your 4.5 years to get a bachelor's degree, you got 2 years of full-time work experience. In college, I learned about brand management, and something I really wanted to do. And I discovered you had to have a master's degree to do that. And I got a half-time fellowship at Michigan State. And so I went out there and earned my MBA. It's sort of an interesting story. I wanted brand management, and I wanted to go to a top company, Procter & Gamble and the old General Foods Corporation, which no longer exists, but that was Maxwell House, Kool-Aid, Jell-O, Bird's Eye, and Post. They interviewed on campus for salespeople. So I signed up for the interview, and I walked into the guy, and I told him, I said, you know, I hope you don't get upset with me, but I would like brand management, and you're not interviewing for that. And the man said, you know, Larry, I'm from Battle Creek, and we all got moved to White Plains, New York a few years back. And they only hire for brand management from Harvard, Columbia, UMichigan, and Stanford in California. I said, oh, my goodness. I said, but this is one of the top 25 schools of marketing in the early mid-60s. So he went back and he talked to some people, and they sent a guy out to interview me from the brand management group at Post Cereals. and they hired me. I was the first one they had ever hired, not from one of those schools.
It's almost like you kind of proved yourself as a salesperson right there. You almost did yourself a disservice.
Well, you know, I was always pretty gutsy. Anyway, what the interesting thing about it is what they would do, they'd bring in like five or six people into the brand group program. We spent 9 months in sales, and I had the Metropolitan New York and North New Jersey as part of my sales area. And then you went through the system. If you didn't make it, they had cuts, and they cut at 2 years, 3 years, and 4 years. I made all the cuts. Only of the original six that started with me, only two of us made it. And here I am, the guy from the Cow College out in the Midwest, you know.
So I know a lot of the background. You had given me a few of the products that you had worked with. And if we could kind of go through your greatest hits a little bit, you started off with Honeycomb cereal, which was the first USA consumer product rolled out nationally without market testing. Why would you not do market testing on that product?
Yeah, I was the third member of the team. I was the junior guy. Because of that, I did a lot of the research grunt work. What happened is they had plant capacity at Battle Creek for making shaped cereal. Post did not have an oat-based product. Also, Frosted Flakes from Kellogg's was a dual audience, the only dual audience cereal. Now, back in those days, 1/10 of a share point, which is 0.001, was $40,000 in factory sales. So if you got a cereal brand to be 2 or 3%, you're talking big money. They did a bunch of consumer research studies and found that people liked the idea of a dual-based cereal. They liked oat-based cereals. They said, you know, there's no risk. We've got the plant capacity. All we have to do is change a few things in the manufacturing, less than a $10,000 investment, we can start making this product. The brand group, the people in charge of the brand group said, you know, instead of spending $1 million test marketing it, why don't we roll it out, go into the top cereal markets first, which happened to be the Northeast. They decided they would make it, roll it out and see what happened. And if it didn't work, they would just pull back. Well, it did work. And within 2 or 3 years, it was one of the top selling brands in the Post line. And then I was, because that was successful and because I had this knack of understanding the research, they gave me a couple of special projects. As a matter of fact, a little side story. I had an MBA student. He ended up at Post Cereals. He called me up. And this is what the amazing thing about today. Now, we're talking about maybe 1991, 92. He called me up. He said, LD, the amount of information that's available today to these brand managers, and I'm in the financial analysis department assigned to a brand group. He said, I found a report that you wrote in 1966.
Wow.
That they still use as the basis for promotional activity. I was given this big assignment, took me 6 months. What they used to do with us is in those early days, every 6 to 8 months, they moved us to another product to see what we were like and to get us well-rounded. And then after about a year and a half, you either got promoted or you didn't. And I was about to be given a group of my own and do some new product. I got recruited away by Pfizer Consumer Products. And that's when I did Bengay and Visine.
When you did Bengay, originally it was marketed to an older demographic for arthritis, but you repositioned it to a multi-strategy brand. Is it a gamble to, I guess, mess with a product's marketing, which is selling well in one group, trying to include more uses? Is that kind of like doubling down in a way?
It could be, except that the consumer products group was a member of a coalition of non-competing companies who did these mega market research projects every year. And one of the things that they did, it was just before I came, they said, what do people use Bengay for? And we found out all those things I repositioned it to came back in the research as that's what they use it for. And all they were marketing for was arthritis. And I said, hey, let's market to all of these others. I mean, it was a highly profitable brand. The cost of goods sold was under 10%. The risk was minimal, because we still had the arthritis. And of course, it was an old brand and well-known. We modernized the packaging graphics and we ran television advertising. And it was very advertising sensitive. And it worked. And I was the hero.
I guess that would probably bring us to Visine eye drops, which would, I guess, maybe be your magnum opus. You mentioned it took 10 months to have Visine become a consumer product. and you work with an ad agency to come up with Visine Gets the Red Out, which I think everybody today still remembers.
Back then, Visine had a patented product, a patented ingredient, and the brand was originally only sold through eye doctors, opticians, and you know they were doing like $4 or $5 million in sales. Once we were done with what we did with it, sales went up like 5 or 6 times in less than 2 years. Brand management during the late 60s up through the early 80s, brand management people and financial management people were the primary source of chief executive officers in many, many corporations because they do the whole business. They know everything. And the challenge of it is you have no direct authority over the people. You have to talk with them, negotiate. They have implied power, but not direct power. It's fascinating. Mm. It's a very fascinating, and it's highly rewarding. But, you know, when I was working in Manhattan, I was probably working 60, 65 hours a week. So that's one of the problems with it.
Did you watch the show Mad Men?
Well, Professor Pat Hertzfeld, I don't know if she's probably retired by now. She asked me once, oh, this was probably around 2009, 2010. When Mad, around the time Mad, she said, Larry, how real is that? And I said, well, I can't talk to you about all the sex stuff they're doing on the show. I said, but as far as the way they talk and the way these advertising people are, I said, that's pretty real. I said, it was really like that. Most of them are, a lot of the advertising people are very strong. Some of them are arrogant. I said, but if you're a brand manager, like I was at a responsible company, you have power. You can say no to them. A brand manager has no power, N-O, but he doesn't have yes power without approval.
There are a lot of shows today that deal with marketing and advertising, you know, that students can use both as kind of a resource or an inspiration. Even YouTube or LinkedIn celebrities like Jordan Belfort, who's the Wolf of Wall Street, or Gary Vaynerchuk. You know, they do podcasts, videos, social media posts, and the new generation of marketing students really love this. And then if you look at reality television, you have shows like Shark Tank and yep. kind of those put the spotlight on bringing a product to market, soup to nuts. So in this day and age where there's so much content, based on your experience in a career, do you think this is a good thing for folks in the marketing industry, or does it muddy the waters a bit in terms of the actual day-to-day responsibilities of a brand manager?
I believe that it helps them because, again, today with all the computer stuff and everything, I think it's better because they have so much information that they can get a hold of.
What types of changes are you seeing now and as an observer that would have really excited you when you were practicing?
Basic strategy considerations don't really change, but they evolve as the culture changes. That's particularly true here in the United States. Tactics, however, you know, strategy being the plan of action where you have an objective and you want to achieve it. And the tactic are the things, the actions you actually take to fulfill the strategy. That kind of basic thinking never changes. What changes is what's going on in the culture. And so today with social media, I mean, if I were out there today, I would be really excited because there's so much more available. It's probably more complex, but it's easier to deal with the complexity because of the computer. You know, Google tracks what you do. If you're using Twitter or Google or Instagram or some of the ones the young people use that I don't even know, it's sort of an invasion of privacy, but from, you know, if I were thinking strictly from a marketing point of view, that's absolutely fantastic.
You know, I mean, who would have thought 10 years ago or 15 years ago, if somebody told you, look, you could have the world at your fingertips, we'll make a computer small enough to fit in your pocket. But the flip side of that is we're going to record everything you say, anything you type, and we're going to use it to sell products to you. I think at the time, people would say, you're out of your mind. This will never happen. People aren't exactly going to agree. But yet it happened, and now here we are. But one thing that really doesn't change is it seems like the professors who are the strictest or the toughest, at the time students are in college, are the most vilified. But yet if you fast forward 20 years, all the alumni I meet talk about their toughest professors being the ones they learn the most from. You had a reputation as being pretty tough. It's well known that you spent some time in the Marine Corps, and alumni that have had you for class still mention that if they showed up for class even 1 minute late, the door would be locked and it would be counted as an absence. So what's your take on why the toughest teachers are the ones who later on are the most appreciated?
Well, along with the toughness has to be, if they're tough for the sake of being tough, that's not enough. They also have to be really good at what they're doing. They know their subject. They like their subject. And along with their strictness or their principles or whatever you call them, there's something behind it that gives them reputation. But tough for the sake of being tough by itself doesn't work. And the reason I think people remember is because what we are all doing in some way is trying to relate to them what the real world is. I used to tell my students, look, we're in the college community right now. You're getting prepared for the rest of your life. And if you're a business student, you got your general education subjects, which are going to help you live your life. And then you got your business subjects. Well, your business subjects are meant to prepare you for the real world. And like it or not, that real world will not conform to you. And I really believe that even today with the young people who, like you say, don't like authority and all of that. Business does not conform to them a whole lot. It will a little bit to recruit them and get them in. But if they don't follow the rules and don't do what they're supposed to do, they get in trouble and they don't make it. So I think it's because what we do is prepare them for reality. I can remember students, you know, who graduate and say, oh, you know, you used to say such and such, and I never knew what you meant. Now I know what you mean because I'm out there and I'm experiencing it, and it makes a lot of sense. And I think that's what happens. Do they still have PDS, Brent, professional development seminars?
We do, yeah. That's still something we hang our hat on as a great way to make sure our students are well-rounded.
That is excellent. And it really sets a Nickel student apart, because I've talked to people in business up before I moved south, and they said, those Nickel students, they know how to take an interview. They come in, they're prepared, they know what they're talking about, they're dressed properly. Most of the people that go to even the big-name schools, they don't know what to do in an interview at first. I mean, what they did with me is after the first 2.5 years, I never taught freshmen and sophomores again. I only taught juniors, seniors, and MBA students, because the attitude was the things I was saying, they didn't understand. I was okay at principles of marketing, and they knew I loved it. But the sophomores didn't like me too much because I was too strict with them, you know? And so I think once they get into their junior year, there's a difference. The students that get that far figure out how the system works, and they pay closer attention. The other thing that makes a teacher effective is you got to be a little bit of a thespian to be a good professor. And if you're not, you know, if you're someone that, and I don't know how many people do this, I never lectured. Oh, well, I did in PDS because you had to. But in my marketing courses and strategic management, I never lectured. I always used a team concept. I gave assignments by team, and the teams came in and reported. And then we had a general discussion afterwards. And I put them in a circle, and I would be in the circle itself. And then I would get up and walk around the circle when I did classes, because I wanted to interact with them. I always had to stop class 5 or 6 minutes before it was over to rearrange the chairs, because a lot of the other professors complained about it. They would walk in and the chairs were all messed up.
you should see the new academic building classrooms. You didn't get your circular classrooms, but they're still square. But it's exactly what you said. The workstations are set up around the perimeters with a professor in the center and a stand. Yeah. And each one of them has all the technology right there to do group projects, or it's really really amazing.
What's the name of that building?
It's New Academic Center. We're still looking for a donor to put their name on it.
None of those rich guys from the 60s and 70s have...
That one's a pretty tall order. That one, if you're shopping, that's one of the stores where they give you a bottle of champagne when you walk in.
That's great. I'm so glad that Nichols is thriving. I really am. I mean, I really liked it at Nichols College. I sat down and figured it out. a few years ago after I retired. I spent close to half my adult life teaching at Nichols College.
It's one of those things where, you know, I've been there 20 years, which, you know, I've done my time on the rock. And the changes that I've seen, like you mentioned, the turnaround that the school did in the late 90s, early 2000s, it's really remarkable. A lot of things went into that. The college was bringing its alumni base together, and whether it was through fundraising or developing connections, it was really getting in its groove when it came to solidifying the alumni network, which then led to the building of the endowment, all these new buildings, all this new technology. And I'm excited to go to work every day because all these great things are happening. Professors are doing work with RPA, robotic process automation. We have a Nichols consulting group now where our students will go out and work with the businesses in the community to do pro bono consulting. We have a student investment fund where the students are trading with real money. So, but the one thing that's remained the same throughout, I think, is the quality of the professors that we have at Nichols.
In my marketing seminar course, which is the capstone course in marketing for seniors, I formed two or three teams each spring, and they went out and did exactly what you're talking about consulting-wise with real companies.
Well, and it gives the students a good basis in working with the real business.
The fact that that's done is really good.
Now moving on to Downsisms, I've heard a lot of alumni mention, probably something you haven't heard for a while.
What do you want to know?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've heard so many alumni mention pieces of advice that you taught them that they still use today, an example of which I interviewed Jim Capiano for a podcast a few weeks ago. His favorite Downsism was never say what you think or you feel. Always say what you know or you believe.
Yeah, you're right. I used to say feelings are something that have no place in your business career. You feel before you go to work, you feel after you go to work, but when you're at work, in your career, you're recommending, you're judging, you're analyzing, you're thinking, you're recommending, or you're doing. Don't feel. Well, the Downsisms were actually, I had a couple of things I used to say in almost all of my marketing classes about marketing. One of them was somewhere in the marketing mix, innovation must exist for the product or the firm to be viable. And I'd say, well, that's number 21. And I just pulled it out of the air. I said, and 22 is perception is the reality, not necessarily the facts. About, I don't know, 3 or 4 years into that, one of the students says, that's a Downsism. Now, if that's 20 and 21, what are the first? I said, I don't know. I just started at 21. And then over the years, we would add to them. So I'll give you the list if you want to hear it.
Yeah, let's do it. I mean,
I might have shared with you that I think it was a couple of years, 2 or 3 years before I retired, a senior was president of the Marketing Communications Club, and they have a T-shirt. They put out a T-shirt, and that only the marketing club members or marketing students or communications students could buy or have. And I'm not going to use student names because I don't think it's appropriate. But the front of it shows a world. And it says, then it's got the 4 P's of marketing: product, price, place, promotion. And then underneath it, it says, marketing makes the world go round, which is something I always said to them. And that was number 18. Well, number one is a personal thing for an individual. And that is, when you blow it or make a mistake, admit it. The second one is, do you know how to eat an elephant? One bite at a time. Number 3 is, honesty is the best policy. Don't be a cheat. Then number 4 is, triers are criers. Be a striver, do it. Number 5 is, when in doubt, don't. Listen before you speak. And of course, the old door locking thing. Sometimes the classes say, oh, come on, Professor Downs, we know such and such had this issue. So sometimes we would let them in. And as soon as they came in and sat down, I would say, promptness is a virtue. 10 is, discretion is the better part of valor. Number 12 is, give yourself time to succeed, onward and upward. And I still Facebook respond to some of my former students that way today. 20, oh, this one you might like, Brent. Success is revenge. Last one is, you can be whatever you want to be if you're willing to pay the price. Now, that one is more aspirational untrue reality, because all 5'6" of me, and when I was in the high school, I weighed 135. When I was in the Marine Corps, I weighed 140. They bulked me up some. I could never be a pro football player at 5'6" and 145 pounds. But if I wanted to achieve something that was possible to achieve, you got to be willing to go for it. As you know, you've spent a lot of years at Nichols. There are good times and bad times. I also became aware, not too long when I was in the Marine Corps, I became aware of this, is you learn more when things are going tough than you do when things are going real good. I don't know why that is, but it seems to be the way it goes. So those are the Downsisms. They were created as I would say things, a student would say, hey, that's a Downsism. We got to write that one down. And so over the years, we created this list. My goal always was, Brent, and I don't know if this is going to fit into one of your questions or not, so maybe I'll be quiet and let you ask questions.
No. Most of the things that kind of pop up that people take away from the podcast, it seems to be the things that are in the ether, you know, stuff that just kind of comes up off the fly.
Well, I never told I've told a few of the people that stay in touch with me, but I've never told all my students. You know, I never thought of my students as students. My goal was, because I identified with the Nichols students right away because I came from a similar background. Nobody had ever been to college in my family before. No one had ever succeeded really well before. I identified with that because a lot of these students, at least when I was there, they were children of successful entrepreneurs who did not have a lot of education, or they were C+, B- students who wanted to go to college. And Nichols always had the view that we'll give them a chance and see if they can make it or not. And that's who I was. I was an underachiever in high school. Marine Corps was the foundation of my adult life. And I went on and graduated second in a class of 5,000 at RIT. And I went on and earned my MBA with distinction. Now, I treated college like it was a job. What I used to think of my students as, because I wanted them to succeed. That's why I was there. I was there to help them get ahead and to maybe share with them some things that I had experienced so they could avoid the pitfalls. But I always thought of them as being nieces and nephews, not students. And I never told them that, but that's how I thought about them, as like they were members of my, not immediate, but my somewhat second level family. And I just felt that way about them. I remember Libba Moore once said to me, she said, Larry, you are so dedicated to your students and yet you're so tough on them. And I said, well, you know, I want them to succeed. Just like Nichols, our business is your success.
I know I've talked to a lot of people that were really excited about the prospect of listening to this. Jason Moran is one of them. Rob Muntz, Don Bean.
I haven't heard from Jason in a long, long time. I hope he's doing well.
He is. In fact, he recommended a student apply to Nichols, a football player. Without naming names, if you don't want to, can you think of any former students that you have stayed in touch with, or memorable students that you had in class, or any funny stories about students in class, which would kind of be interesting? And again, if you don't want to use a name, I'm sure whoever's listening will be like, oh my God, that's me.
This male was an athlete, and he was one of these folks who sometimes was present and sometimes wasn't. And he was scheduled in the PDS for a given day to do an interview. They were supposed to be second, and he was going to interview somebody, and they had to, you know, they had to be prepared. And the first interview ended, and the came for the second one, and the person that was going to be interviewed walks up, and then he walks up and said, oh, he said, I'm really not prepared, and I'm not going to be able to do it. And I said, okay. I said, we'll just move on. I said, however, I want you to stay after class. I purposely ended that class a little early. Girlfriend stayed with him. And he came up to me and I said, well, what's the matter? Are you ill? Are you all right? He said, well, I'm having trouble with my fallopian tubes and I hurt. And his girlfriend punched him so hard she almost knocked him over. She said, you don't have fallopian tubes, you jerk. There's a few people who have stayed with me 10, 15 years. He was recruited away by a company that his brother worked at that was Japanese owned. Now, his brother was from the early 90s, and he was an excellent student and has been very successful. His brother was 8 or 9 years later. And in 98, 99, this company asked the first guy, is there anybody else like you? And he said, yeah, my brother, but he's still in college. Well, they actually made him an offer that was just unbelievable. And so he came to me and talked about it. And Dr. Tom Leland and I, we said to him, tell them that you need until the end of the spring semester to make up your mind and see what they say. And so what we did is the next semester, we fast-tracked him through some senior marketing courses and the strategic management course, and he left. He did part-time and online for a while. I don't think he ever finished the degree. He's been entirely successful. At age 38, he was president and CEO of a $20 million company. And he said he owes it all to Nichols and what he learned at Nichols. We had to move to Florida for my wife's health reasons. And he called me up one day and he said, are you living in Florida? And I said, yeah. He said, do you know anybody down here? I said, no. He said, how long you been here? I said, oh, we've been here 7-8 months. He said, you're adopted. You're coming to our house. And they live about 2 hours from us. You're coming to our house for Thanksgiving and Christmas for as long as you want. And he's become an excellent friend. And that's a former student.
Wow.
Also, we've been invited and attended 4 weddings of students of mine. And one of them, they treated us like we were royalty and we weren't even part of the family. And there were a couple of family members who were wondering who the heck we were. But, you know, I just love my students. You know, they're great. And I hope that they're all doing very well and that they're as loyal to Nichols as most of them are. The Nichols Alumni Network is unbelievable at how they stay in touch with each other after the fact and help each other and so on. And I want to encourage them to continue to do that because that is very, very strong. And I wish them the best as well.
And you guys ride this out and we'll ride it out up here. And it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you very much. You have a great day as well.
Welcome to the pen, the herd taking the court. We going for a win, we going for it all. We'll do it till we